It's no surprise that updating the electricity grid today will make for a better tomorrow. Increased self-sufficiency is just one of the benefits. The Great Grid Upgrade will also boost the economy and create new green jobs. And best of all, you can continue doing the things you love, like watching the latest epic nature documentary or listening to this podcast while caring for the planet too. Find out more at nationalgrid.com.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Today, healthier is happening at CVS Health in more ways than you've ever seen. It's wellness destinations for seniors, including select locations with Oak Street Health and CVS Pharmacy. It's doctors, nurses, pharmacists, and everyone in between, offering quality care and support virtually, in person, and on the phone. It's in-home evaluations through Signify Health and meeting mental health needs through Aetna. And those are just a few of the ways healthier is happening. To see more, visit cvshealth.com/healthierhappenstogether. CVS Pharmacy, Oak Street Health, CVS Specialty, Signify Health, and Aetna are part of CVS Health. Eligibility and services vary by location and individual.
Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
St. David's Day, the 1st of March, and I've driven along the M4 from Wales to near Reading, the Roman town of Silchester. I'm here to meet a fellow podcaster, Matthew Bannister, a broadcaster extraordinaire. He runs and presents a podcast called Folk on Foot, which is all about folk music and very much like the podcast, lots of adventures in the landscape. And I'm just about to meet him. We're going to have a wander around. Why Roman Silchester in the middle of Hampshire? Well, it's equidistant between where we live, so we thought it'd be a good idea to finally meet and share the love of landscape and stories from the landscape, music from the landscape. And really looking forward to meeting him. It's been a long time coming. So, just waiting for him to arrive. It's a cold, cold day, though, and When I left Wales, there was snow on the mountains. Welcome to the podcast. I'm Fergus, I'm the host, and one of our very last in the season of Tales from the Landscape. Matthew, how very nice to meet you, finally.
It's great to meet you, Fergus.
And we're at, the sun has just come out, literally as I turned on the recorder, the magic of podcasting. It's a spring day, it's St. David's Day. We've met midway between our homes in Silchester, little Dunnock singing behind us. A fellow podcaster.
Yes.
I'm really interested in picking your brain, finding out your secrets.
But also talking about... do very much the same thing. We go walking in the countryside, and we have the joys and excitement of recording in the wild surroundings. So
whatever
you get
turns
the
up.
Intervention of birdsong and rivers and so on, but you also get the wind and the rain, and sometimes that can be difficult when it's recording time, can't
it? I'm also keeping my balance. I quite often take a tumble with, and this is we're sort of, you can hear a squelching,
great squelching mud, because it's been really torrential rain over the last couple of days here.
Yeah,
and I knew there was hope, though, because as I drove here this morning I saw two rainbows. So I knew that there was going to be hope for that the sun might come out.
It's magical, thankfully. So, we are at Silchester, a Roman city, for no particular reason, apart from that neither of us have been here before.
Exactly.
And we like telling tales of the landscape, so hopefully some tales will emerge, along with the rooks up ahead. But your podcast is called Folk on Foot. Could you tell us about, I've been listening to some episodes, but could you tell us a little bit about the essence of Folk Offered?
Yes, it's a very simple concept. In each episode, I go walking with a leading UK or Irish folk musician in a landscape that has inspired their music. And they sing and play on that location. And that's the joy of it. So what it does is it exploits the absolute connection between folk music and place. And when you ring folk musicians and say, would you like to take part in this? They absolutely get it, because folk music is so often specific to a particular place, a particular region, and even contemporary songs that are being written by folk musicians are often inspired by the natural world or inspired by the geography of where they come from. So we go for these walks, we have conversations, and above all, we have this sublime music played completely acoustically in the open air.
I've been listening to some of your episodes, particularly the Mourne Mountains, which was beautiful, beautiful, but playing live in the open air, up on top of a mountain in the wind. I take my hat off because I find it hard enough just to record a conversation.
Well, I must say that I have a producer who comes with me, and she is absolutely brilliant, and she's won awards for her music production.
Oh, God,
and she's brilliant at capturing those unique performances. And we rarely do more than one take. That's the lovely thing about it. I remember we were with the actor and musician Johnny Flynn on the Hackney Marshes.
He's a real hero.
Wonderful. Yeah, we walked twice with him, once on the Hackney Marshes and once with Robert McFarlane, the nature writer, with whom he collaborates musically. But Johnny made a mistake in the song, and we said, shall we do it again? And he said, oh no, leave it in. That is what happened here. And let's convey that to our listeners. There's lots of...
These are rooks. Yeah.
Rooks above us.
We must be nearing a rookery. And they'll be already breeding. I've got a skylark as well. This is great. There's all sorts of... Well, we're going to get lots of good things now.
I love the happenstance of being in the outdoors and things. That's what's joyful for Folk on Foot too. And in Johnny Flynn's case, he was playing the theme from Detectorists, which is one of his most famous songs. And a train hooter went off. And he just said, that was almost in key, and carried on with the song.
I really want to talk. I mean, you worked for the BBC for a long time, so you'll have been in those edit suites. And is it liberating to just make a programme that's raw and natural? And
yes. I mean, it's liberating. One of the great things is to escape the straitjacket of the schedule.
Yes.
You know, if you work on Radio 4, as I do, then programmes are half an hour or 15 minutes or 45 minutes, and they're exactly that because they need to fit in before the pips come on or the weather forecast has to fit in and so on. In podcasting, you make them as long as they need to be.
So going back to folk, just because I definitely want to come back to the radio and your career, which is really fascinating, but folk music is in your blood. Is that the reason you started it?
Yes. I mean, it started when I was a teenager, actually, and I grew up in Sheffield. And all the things that come together in Folk on Foot, in a way, started there in my teenage years. I was learning the classical violin, and I found it, to be honest with you, a bit tedious. All the scales and arpeggios and all the rest of it. But then I heard an album called Liege and Leaf by Fairport Convention, which is really known as the first folk rock album. And it was the first time that a rock band had taken traditional British music and turned it into this kind of new art form. And it features right in the foreground the electric violin of Dave Swarbrick. And I suddenly realised that the violin might possibly be cool and could be exciting. And so I got a pickup and I formed a band, and I was in a folk band touring around the folk clubs of Sheffield and North Derbyshire when I was a teenager. In fact, the first time I appeared on the radio wasn't as a broadcaster, it was doing a session on the Radio Sheffield Folk Show.
Is that how you got into
playing?
It?
No, that was not the way into broadcasting at all. It was before I even went to university. It was when I was 17. But we did a session playing on the Radio Sheffield Folk Show with my band. So folk music got under my skin, and it was really about the fact that I identified somehow with this this was my cultural heritage. This wasn't the American rock and roll that I've been listening to. This was from our cultural heritage. And that Fairport Convention album set me off on a journey into looking at the ballads and the original material that they'd found their sources from, and listening to the other musicians who were making folk music, part of that 1960s and 70s folk revival that was going on, Martin Carthy, people like that. And so folk music got under my skin and has remained under my skin, although I did keep quiet about it when I was controller of Radio 1, so I thought it might not be quite hip enough
they
for people.
They might think you were going to subvert
I was going to have a lot of finger-in-the-ear stuff going out on Radio 1, which I wasn't. So folk music was there, and walking came into my life too, because in Sheffield, we lived on that side of Sheffield which is near the Peak District, and we were able to get out into the Peak District. Now, often under sufferance with my parents, you know, taking me, dragging me out there,
yeah,
to
that's,
do it.
That's how we all get into it.
Exactly. Sort of, but then you think, actually, there's something to this. And I also used to walk through the city, because I used to stay at friends' houses listening to music late into the night, and then I realised there's no buses, I haven't got any money for a taxi. So I used to walk right across the city in the early hours of the morning, and I found it a hugely contemplative experience, and I really like that. So I like walking in cities as well as in the countryside.
Yeah, yeah, no, I get that. I think, particularly when you're young and your first jobs are in the city, and you love walking, there's a great joy in I spend my time in London just wandering, exploring these little villages after village hidden,
yeah,
in the cities,
and fantastic, finding the green spaces that are hidden away in cities,
for
and
sure.
So on.
Folk music, I mean, you say it's part of our cultural heritage, it's everywhere, but actually quite hard to find for some people. I think it's sort of, it feels like it's
good morning.
Hello there.
Hey. It's almost like hidden away in pubs and clubs, and has a bit of an image of slightly being on the edge.
Well, I think there's a difference in England from Scotland, Wales and Ireland, because in Scotland, Wales and Ireland, music of their culture is very much part of the mainstream, really, and it seems to me, you know, it has never gone away. Whereas in England, there's something, people find it a bit associated with Morris dancing and waving hankies about and bells and things like that, which it is associated with, and I don't want to deny that. But there is a big folk scene going on all over the country. And there used to be a magazine called F Roots magazine, which every summer published a supplement of all the folk festivals that were happening. And there were hundreds of folk festivals, small and large, going on up and down the country. And there are lots of new young performers coming into folk music as well, exciting performers who are taking it in new directions and reinterpreting the tradition. So I think that folk music is in a really vibrant state. And I, just having mentioned Morris dancing, I should say that we've been working with an all-female Morris dancing side called Boss Morris.
Oh, yes, I know them, yes.
Yeah, well, they appeared on the Brit Awards with a band called Wet Leg.
Oh, yes.
So, you know, Morris dancing hit the mainstream for a time. And Boss Morris are also artists, and they have beautiful costumes and face painting. And so they're finding new ways of interpreting that tradition. And it's perhaps surprising for people who associate it with bearded old men.
And pints of beer.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And although nobody objects to a pint of beer on a village green.
No, and I wish there was a village green and a pint. It's not quite the weather for that. But I was very interested in listening to your podcast with, was it Sandra Kerr?
Sandra Kerr, yes. Part of the great folk revival of the 50s, 60s and 70s, yeah.
And she, for many listeners, will know Bagpuss from our childhood. So a sort of,
she did the music
animation
for that.
Yeah,
yes.
Incredible. I mean, very, very, what's the word? It was so atmospheric. Even though it was a children's TV show, the animations were incredible. And it was so quirky. But the music, I still remember it.
Yeah, well, she actually played Madeline in the
rag doll
series, the rag doll, and Bagpuss, of course, is the baggy old cloth cat, and it's really a series that was ahead of its time in terms of recycling, because it was all about mending and make do and
mend.
And then there were the mice that came in, but the music was often a way into traditional music for people, because Sandra Kerr and John Faulkner, who was then her husband, you know, they made the music using auto harps and all sorts of things, and they took traditional ideas and then compose new songs as well to add to it. And the nostalgia is such that now it's hitting its 50th birthday in 2024.
Bagpuss.
Bagpusses. But it's been repeated so often that Sandra now meets successive generations of people who say, oh, that really turned me on to traditional music. That really was part of my childhood. So she's an amazing character because she, in the 50s, 60s and 70s, she worked with Ewan McColl and Peggy Seeger, two of the great figures of the folk revival of the 60s. She was their basically live-in nanny. And in return for that, she got music lessons from them and performance lessons from Ewan McColl, who came from an acting background as well. And he used the techniques of Stanislavski to teach them how to embody the characters of ballads that they were singing in folk clubs. So there was a very serious attempt going on in that period to make folk singing professional, you know, and to improve the quality of it.
Back of the bar type.
Exactly, yeah. So he was doing that, and Sandra was one of the people involved.
We've just arrived at a sort of farmstead here with a beautiful church and surrounded by daffodils, even though it's minus something or other. We can see this Roman town here. Just some of the sort of ramparts at the edge of this Roman town. So I'm hoping we're going to get a bit closer.
It was quite a big establishment here, wasn't it?
Yeah, I think it was a proper city.
Yeah.
10,000 people or something, which was quite a lot in those days. And not a lot to see now, but it'd be quite nice to get a bit closer. So it's a folk revival. I think a lot of people think of folk music in a sense of it's nostalgic, it's talking about the past, it's talking about loss and love. I mean, I was at some Welsh folk music recently, and they said Welsh folk music is either very sad or very, very sad. And this piece I'm going to play you is very, very, very sad.
Can I give you an example that maybe counteracts that? Because
yeah,
we did an episode in Wales with an artist called Cynefin, whose real name is Owen Shires, but he takes that Welsh name as his performance name, and a writer called Amy Jane Beer, who's won the Wainwright Prize recently for her book called The Flow on Rivers.
Yeah.
And Owen made a whole album about the River Cletta in Wales, and Amy wrote a chapter of her book about him and his work on this. So the three of us went for a walk up the river. It sounds as though we're in the river now. We're just washing through a puddle. Went for a walk up the river, and Owen has both traditional and contemporary songs that have come from the river. And so people who lived in that area wrote songs about their experience of the river and how much it meant to them. And he performs those songs in Welsh on the banks of the river for us. And then Amy Jane fills in all the knowledge that she has about the importance importance of rivers in our culture and how the effect of walking along a river can have a wonderful effect on you psychologically and so on. So this is more of an uplifting thing than the very, very sad experience you had of Welsh folk music, I have to say.
Very beautiful. But that sort of leads me on to the next question, really, which is modern folk music reflecting the times we live in the sense of, you know, we're facing... I like being out in nature, but I'm 52 years old and I've seen the decline, and all the stories of change, our environmental change, our habitat loss. But also we've got political change. We've got a lot of politics going on at the moment. I mean, it's societal change. Does folk music reflect that?
I think it does, some musicians more than others. And, you know, I'm thinking about Sam Lee, who's a wonderful both naturalist and folk singer. And we've been walking with Sam, and Sam takes part in the Right to Roam movement and in the environmental protest movement, and is very much involved in trying to campaign for greater access to countryside and also to campaign for a greater awareness of the impact of mankind on the environment. But he's also a singer and a wonderful musician.
And that infuses his music.
In the way the music celebrates the natural world. I mean, one of the things that he does, which is so gorgeous, is that he does something called singing with nightingales.
Oh, we've actually got a podcast about
that. Have you done that? Yeah, we've done an episode about it too.
Oh,
and
wonderful.
I mean, well, this nightingale was in full flow and Sam sang with it.
Yeah.
And then there was a violin player with him who played violin with the nightingale, and I swear the nightingale responded.
town. Yeah. We're just beside a beautiful flint church, a traditional Southern England, Hampshire, Sussex church, that is, with the sort of, obviously not here since Roman times, but I imagine it's probably mostly medieval.
It looks like an ancient foundation though, doesn't it?
So it would have seen some more of the ruins here, I think, but when it was built. But it's kind of splendid.
And I love this, we're in the graveyard around it now, and I love the fact that the daffodils are coming out here, and the little splashes of colour where people have either planted flowers or laid flowers on the graves. And there's snowdrops over there as well, I think.
It's that sort of weird time of year, isn't it, where we know it's spring, there's warmth in the sun, but actually the countryside's incredibly drab. there's a raven, though. There's a raven here somewhere. Oh, there he goes.
There he is.
Yeah. Raven's busy, rooks are busy. They're all these corvids are nesting now. So while we're freezing and our hands are going numb, the birds are getting on with it. And I kind of like that.
Yes, it's wonderful.
They're spirited.
Just adding to your collection of gates.
Gate noises, yes. Gate noises of the podcast. This is a good one. This is rather nice, subtle. Yeah, that's lovely. It's the kind of great squeaking iron things that have, or aluminium gates. So we're hopefully going to be storming the town very soon. We're on the walls here.
We are, aren't we?
We are. You can see there's sort of flints and all sorts coming through. But yes, we're on the walls of Silchester. Caliva is the Roman name for this town. We're the only people here. It's rather good. This is probably the least populated it's ever been.
And you can see the size of it because we're walking quite a long way around the edges of it, aren't we? And it's a very big area.
20 football pitches or something like that.
Yeah, and there were bathhouses and palaces and so on.
Amphitheatre. I think there's an amphitheatre here. So
yes, I think they had gladiators and entertainments of that kind.
It's incredibly peaceful. Yes, you can see the edge of the wall here. We've just come down some steps and there's a gap and a road. We've got a cross-section of this Roman wall, which has obviously been here for 1700 years.
That's about a metre and a half thick, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah. Yes, it shows that they probably had some enemies then.
Yes.
Particularly towards the end.
I love that sense of connecting with the past, which you have when you come to a place like this. And, you know, part of the joy of doing Folk on Foot has been to take us to bits of the countryside that I wouldn't otherwise have gone to. And the history sometimes just rears up at you out of the landscape, and you see a Bronze Age burial mound or some Roman remains or whatever. And I love that sense that you are walking in the footsteps of people who were here centuries ago. And
presumably played music and sang and had their own entertainment.
Well, of course, yeah.
It's very, very boggy up here. This is going to be the great... This is for you, Jack. My producer loves a squelch.
This is Squelch City, isn't it?
Really, yes, yes. Maybe that's what Caliva means. So do you have it's a very difficult question for you because it means picking somebody, but do you have a favourite artist that you always go back to? I know you don't want to sort of put off all the others.
It's also like choosing between your children in a way, you know, because I'm passionate.
Or maybe a favourite tune rather than
artist. An interesting question.
One that you were talking about gathering in the Mourne Mountains.
Oh, Wild Mountain Time,
Wild
of
Mountain
course.
Time,
very famous song, and one of the things that we discuss about that. And
Will you go, lassie, go?
Yes. And we'll all go together to pull Wild Mountain Time all amongst the blooming heather, although I'm told that thyme and heather aren't necessarily in bloom at the same time.
It's
but
a whole load of... It's the old Swifts in Autumn thing that drives me mad.
But the lovely thing about that song is that it's... It's very evocative to me of a time that I spent in Scotland. But on the podcast in the Mountains of Mourne, they claim it as an Irish song. And I think it's part of the joy of folk music that it does move from place to place.
Yeah.
And you encounter different versions of the same song in different locations. So in the Sandra Kerr episode, she plays as the Northumberland version of Scarborough Fair, which is called Whittingham Fair.
Oh, I heard that, yes, beautiful.
So it's a very similar set of lyrics about the cambric shirt and parsley, sage, rosemary and thyme, But it's, are you going to Whittingham Fair?
Yeah.
Not are you going to Scarborough Fair?
Everybody's got their own fair.
And it's been annexed by them. So in terms of the musical thing, I mean, my head is so full of music, and I have a big collection of vinyl records of, you know, both new ones and old ones, and I tend to pick and choose from it according to my mood. But I could talk about one memorable experience on the podcast, which I do tend to refer to, which was going to Sandwood Bay, which is in the far northwest tip of Scotland.
Very beautiful. Yeah, very, very beautiful.
Near to Cape Wrath.
Yeah.
And there's an artist called Duncan Chisholm, who's a violin player, fiddle player. And he has written a whole album about Sandwood Bay, inspired by Sandwood Bay, instrumental music. And we went on the walk, 4 miles walk from the car park to the white sand beach on a day a bit like this, actually, where the sun was out but the wind was blowing.
You do need to, it's a big effort to get there. I mean, it's 4 miles just to get to the beach.
4 miles to walk there, yes,
you
exactly.
Can't drive there. Yeah.
And when you get there on that particular day, there was nobody else there. And the waves were coming in, and there's a sort of sea stack at one end of the beach, and then Cape Wrath is away to your right. And it's the most atmospheric place. And he had been there 14 or 15 times when he was making the album, in all weathers, with storms coming in, black from the sea. And to hear him then take out his fiddle and stand on that beach and play the music that had been inspired by that, those elements and that place, just made the hairs on the back of my neck stand on end. And so that beautiful. Was one of the most memorable occasions that we've had. But all of them are memorable in their own way, because every time I go out, I'm getting a private concert for one.
Yes, yes.
You know,
that's rather cunning how you said
this. And what we like to try and do, you know, when we're putting them together, is to share that experience with our listeners, so that they experience the absolute feeling of joy that we get when we're in these beautiful places hearing this gorgeous music. I'm astonished to see how much has survived here and how high the walls were, because that's almost its full height, isn't it?
Yeah.
I think on our left here.
You can see the construction techniques are still very clear to see. There's larger slabs and then infill with flint. What an amazing place. The wall contained 40,000 cubic metres of construction material. 150,000 cartloads of stone. That's a lot of work.
Yeah. And it says they're using stone rather than ceramic tile for the levelling courses, and the stone came from the Bath Cirencester region. Imagine having to transport it from Bath Cirencester to here in the days of no
a motor, good 80 miles away. Yeah. They were an amazing bunch, weren't they? I mean, it's just we couldn't build it today.
Probably not, no. It would certainly run over time and over budget, wouldn't it, if we were doing it today?
Yeah, we'd cancel it at some stage.
Yeah. And we're going in now through a gateway,
through
aren't
gateway,
we?
Yeah,
it looks like the main entrance to the town.
Yeah, the town is just a field, sadly, but a skylark field. And it's the town of Caliva is now buzzards and skylarks. And some good buzzard noises today. Is there any better natural music than skylarks?
I love the skylarks, and you always think of Ralph Vaughan Williams and The Lark Ascending, don't you? He was a great folk song collector.
I was going to talk, because Sandra Kerr talked about him and said that he'd collected the ones he wanted to collect and perhaps wasn't as comprehensive as people think he was.
Well, there's a suggestion that Cecil Sharp and Vaughan Williams and others who were collecting folk songs in the early part of the 20th century had a kind of rose-tinted view of what the countryside should be like and what rural life was like, and they went out to look for the songs and the music that matched that view.
That fitted the,
so they didn't collect a lot of industrial songs, for example, or songs from cities, because they were looking for a more rural, because they, I think they were worried that the rural traditions were being lost as the Industrial Revolution happened and the move to the cities happened, and so they wanted to preserve these songs of the rural life. But there are some experts nowadays suggest that they had a particular view and they collected in order to fulfill that view and ignored some other aspects of folk song.
Ignored the rawer
and the more grim and yeah. You know, although, you know, folk song's constantly full of murder and it's full of adultery, so, you know, it's not as if it's kind of sanitized. It can be quite X-rated.
Yes.
But I think they had a kind of view of swains frolicking in the, you know, in the milking parlour, and it wasn't quite like that.
Rosy-cheeked milkmaids.
Exactly. But there's a lovely, talking of skylarks, there's a lovely, in one of our episodes with Corinne Polwart on a moor called Fala Moor in Midlothian. She's just singing a song called The Lark in the Clear Air, which is a famous folk song, and the skylarks go up behind her, as if on cue.
Oh, really? How perfect. We're just... this is quite slippery. This is a very perilous... I don't think I filled out all the...
all the health and safety
health
forms.
Safety and...
And we're right behind the brambles here.
Brambles and slippery slopes. So hopefully this isn't just a kind of badger track.
I hope it's not a dead end. We're always up for exploration.
The holidays have arrived early with Blinds.com's Spring Black Friday sale. Upgrading window coverings can be a minor project with a major impact. Blinds.com makes it easy and affordable. Browse premium blinds, shades, shutters. We have your patio covered too. And get unlimited window treatments installed for one low cost. Free shipping and Blinds.com's 100% satisfaction guarantee. Shop Blinds.com's Spring Black Friday sale now. Save up to 45% plus premium doorbusters. Up to 45% off at Blinds.com. Rules and restrictions may apply.
Just making our way through an ever-decreasing track, and I'm hoping that this will actually bring us out somewhere. It's following the top of the walls, and I realised I'd taken Matthew into quite the wrong part of the world, but it looks like people do walk through here.
Definitely. I think there have been other human beings passing through here, not just...
Since the Romans.
Animals, yeah, exactly.
So there may be light at the end of the wall. All sorts of these might be bluebells coming through here.
Oh yeah.
First blue, just the green shoots, little spears coming up. Is that a way down? That looks perilous. Do you fancy disembarking here?
Steep scramble down.
Yeah,
the
should,
side
should
of the
we
wall.
Try that with a
across a fallen tree.
Yeah, it's a high peril. Climbed the Mourne Mountains. This isn't a... So I think we're now in the outer ditch. So we've got the wall to our right, and the outer ditch defence. Quite a substantial ditch with water in the bottom, and it's nicely wooded. So I think we've...
Wouldn't like to be attacking this, would you?
No.
I'm sure they'd be pouring boiling oil on your head before you could get a bit through that ditch.
Yes. Yeah. Arrows and swords and spears and pylon. Matthew, so you... talked about you mentioned that you'd been in charge of Radio 1.
Right. Yeah, so I've my background is kind of a game of two halves. So I started out as a news reporter in BBC Local Radio in Nottingham, and then I worked at Capital Radio and at Radio 1 Newsbeat as a newsreader. And then I went into management, and I ran the BBC's London station, GLR. I ran Radio 1, I was director of radio, chief executive of production, and then finally director of marketing and communications for the BBC. But in the year 2000, I decided I'd had enough of all that and gave it up and went back to broadcasting. So more recently, I've worked on the World Service, doing a programme called Outlook. I've worked on Radio 5 Live, doing my own late-night show. And I currently work on Radio 4 doing an obituary programme, the weekly obituary programme called Last Word.
So your voice is so familiar, will be familiar to so many listeners for all that, because you've been a voice on the radio for, well...
Over 40 years.
Well, right, I didn't want to go
there. I'm afraid to say, yes.
So when I was doing a little bit of research, I saw at one stage you'd gone for the director generalship of the BBC, which is the head job.
Yeah,
the top job.
Top yeah.
job. Probably one of the hardest jobs in any sort of broadcasting, and perhaps in any sort of British corporation.
Yes. Well, I mean,
what
happened was that I was at that time number three in the hierarchy of the BBC. So I was chief executive of BBC production, in charge of all the television and radio production in England, except for news. So we had the Natural History Unit in Bristol, and the Proms, and the Radio 1 production, and Top of the Pops, and EastEnders, and movies, and all sorts of things. So it was running the biggest production house in Europe, effectively, in television, radio, and online content. And so I was near the top of the BBC, and the job became vacant, and I thought, well, I better have a crack at this. Yeah. But I'm really happy I didn't get it. I mean, for a number of reasons. First of all, I was increasingly unhappy at that time in being away from the creative process, because managing the biggest production house in Europe is not particularly creative. It's more about budget, staff deployment, targets, etc., etc. It's not about the process of having ideas and creating. That's what your teams do,
but you
don't do it. So I was increasingly frustrated with it, and the job opened up, so I had a go at it, and I think it was they were right not to appoint me, and I was absolutely delighted not to have got it. Yeah. And Greg Dyke got the job and did a much better job than I would have done. But what it made me do was think again about what I wanted to do in life, and I thought, well, I don't want to sit in these meetings. What I want to do is get back to making radio programmes, which is what I'd really done all my life, with a small team of like-minded creative people. And so that's when I went back to broadcasting, and after having left the management, it took me 2 years to get back in, but they eventually gave me a show on 5 Live as a broadcaster.
So there's a lesson there in creativity is the thing that brings most joy for you.
Yes. And having, you know, working with a small team of people, having ideas and then putting them into action. And that Folk on Foot is the absolutely prime example, because it's my own project and I had this idea. And the joy of podcasting is that nowadays you don't have to get commissioned by anybody. You don't have to ask anybody's permission. You know, when I was starting out, there were only two routes to market in radio. You could either be on a commercial radio station or a BBC radio station, and they were the gatekeepers. Now you can put your podcast out there and see if an audience comes. And I managed to persuade 2 or 3 really creative people to work with me on it. And we put it out, and an audience has come. And that's the joy of it, is that there's a freedom for people who have ideas to put them out there and see if they can get an audience, and then if they can persuade that audience to give them a few bob to keep it going.
Yes, the loyalty is the thing, and the joy of someone responding and saying that you've made a difference to their lives.
Oh, well, that's true.
Which I bet you get.
Yeah, we definitely do. And, I mean, there's a lovely review in the Telegraph of Folk on Foot, which said the music is transcendent, the sense of place is transporting, and if you need escape, it's a restorative breathing space in sound. And I love that, a restorative breathing space in sound. And there's a buzzard.
Buzzard agreed.
I mean, that's what I think we are. And you are very much the same, you know, that you take us into places. Listening to your colleague Kevin going into a haunted, or supposedly chapel. Haunted chapel. And I was transported with him to that place. And it took me away from the cares of the daily news schedule and the worries about the gas bill and all the rest of it into a better place. Which, and I think that's what we have in common.
Absolutely. Absolutely. A little bit of wood sorrel there or something. It's just like little flowers appearing and dog's mercury, which is the least exciting flower in the... But it does come out early.
Oh,
this
yes, there it
here.
Is.
Little white flowers on a very... Much, I think people walk past dog's mercury and never ever know what it is, but it is, it's like the meadow pipit of the plant world, the little green job.
I'm so envious of your knowledge, because I'm an expert in absolutely nothing, and well only because I've been taught it now by some wonderful musicians, some lessons. Yes. But I don't claim to be an expert, and I think that's another part of my blundering appeal on the podcast, is that I wander in and ask questions that perhaps other people who know too much wouldn't ask.
Just try up here and see what's this way. There's a bit more town, I think, but we've circumnavigated the...
We're going right the way round, aren't we? Yeah.
We've done it, but we could just have a look up here. There might be a little bit more. Maybe the amphitheatre might be this way. I wanted to go back to a couple of things, back on the BBC and your job. If you... Having sort of worked in the BBC and now still presenting, but you can see it from a bit more perspective possibly these days. If you had some advice to give to the BBC in these really quite turbulent times, and this may be a bit of a...
Yes, I mean, what would I give the advice to the BBC? I mean, the BBC is at one of the most challenging times, possibly the most challenging time of its entire existence, in my humble opinion. And it's beset by different forces. So the first one is the changing nature of public debate. And because public debate has become so polarised, nobody believes that you're impartial unless you're on their side.
Exactly,
and
yes.
The BBC has to steer a course by embracing all sides of an argument and listening to all different shades of opinion within the law. And so the polarised nature of debate means that more people are more angry with the BBC than they've ever been. And there are more ways of them expressing that through social media. So there's that pressure to maintain its impartiality in news and current affairs. And then, of course, there's the pressure just of the sheer volume of content that there now is. There's a number of other things you can do apart from listening to and watching the BBC. And especially if you're young and you're on TikTok or YouTube or...
Yes, you're not going to be going onto the normal BBC channels.
That's, you know, the issue is how do you engage with the younger audiences in the places where they want to be engaged with. And Radio 1, which I used to run, which is very interesting, is now so much more than a radio station, and I always thought this was the right route. It must become a multimedia brand, because that's where its young target audience are. So it should be judged just as much on how successful it is on its YouTube channel as it is on its radio listing, you know, traditional radio listening figures. And it should be judged by going to places where young people are, rather than just regarding itself as a stream of music and chat coming out of a radio station. Because otherwise, you know, so its podcasting output and its, you know, its multimedia content is as much part of what Radio 1 is now, despite its name, as the radio station is. And the radio is becoming traditional radio is a much less potent force for young audiences. So I think, you know, my advice to the BBC would be to stand up for yourself and to argue why we need the BBC more now than we have ever needed it. Because we need a source of impartial, fact-checked news and current affairs, as there is so much lies and fake news and
AI generated the more
that stuff arrives, the more you need somebody who focuses, however imperfectly, on trying to tell you the facts as clearly and impartially as possible. Secondly, we need that investment in our culture, you know, because the BBC is a massive piece of cultural intervention, and it's a sort of successful cultural intervention. You know, there are always arguments about grant giving and arts councils and all the rest of it, but the BBC does things and can then be judged by the fact that people come to them. So they make popular culture and they make high culture, you know, and they're investing in writers, musicians, artists, camera people. And that is a huge piece of successful cultural patronage. And the final thing is, what a powerful force the BBC is around the world for Britain. You know, I mean, when I was on the World Service, World Service, you know, for 10 years, and it's a totally different response that you get from the audience. The audience, because on Radio 4 they tend to write in to complain. On the World Service, they tend to write in to tell you how much they love you, because they can't find that level of impartiality and that level of clarity anywhere else in some of these countries. And you get such an outpouring of appreciation. And if you go to other countries and mention the BBC, they associate the BBC with some of the best values of British culture. So the BBC has got a great case to make. It's in terrible headwinds, so it's difficult for it to make it, and there are many enemies who get in its way trying to stop it from making it. But I would ask it to stand up and be proud of itself, and of course constantly reevaluate what you're doing and try and make it better, but stand up for yourself and stand up and be proud of what the BBC is.
What's the happiest job you've ever done?
Oh, this is it. Folk on Foot.
Folk on Foot,
definitely the happiest job I've ever done. I mean, in a way, it's sort of designed to be my perfect job. Yeah. And, you know, because
you designed it.
Exactly. It involves my three, you know, greatest passions, which are music, walking in nature and in cities, and creating stories in sound. You know, because that's really what I've done my whole career. Mm. You know, and I love the craft of radio and the producers that I work with are incredibly talented, and we, you know, we've won lots of awards on Folk on Foot because we set out right from the beginning to make it completely beautiful in radio terms, and our peer group have recognised that by handing us lots of gongs.
That's good,
and
yes.
And so that gives me huge satisfaction, because in a way that's the essence of my whole 40-year career, is I love making stories in sound, and that's what Folk on Foot does.
Finally, we talked a little bit about BBC and what advice you'd give the BBC, but what about the wider countryside? You've seen a lot, you travel really widely. I'm slightly envious of how far and wide you get. Orkney, Mourne Mountains, and you know, Suffolk, all the corners, all 10 corners of the country. What, if you had a magic wand, what would you change for the better? What is the thing that boils your blood and you'd like to change?
Well, there are so many challenges for the countryside, aren't there,
as we know,
and I'm sure lots of your guests have enunciated those. Mm. I think that the right to access to the countryside is a really interesting one, and I've just come back from Scotland, where there is a right to roam enshrined in law, which seems to be operating pretty well.
It's a fascinating development.
And I keep bumping up against people on the podcast who are campaigning for that same right to be extended to England. And I think that their argument is, and I think it's a powerful one, is that the more access you give to people to the countryside, the more they will care about it and the more they will take care of it.
Yeah.
You know, obviously the counter argument is if you give them access, they'll damage it in some way or they'll cause the trouble. But the argument I find most potent is, because it's the way I feel, is that the more I'm exposed to the countryside, the more I love it, the less I want it to be damaged, and the more I think that it should be preserved and saved. I think giving people access to the countryside as of right would be a rather wonderful thing.
It's the lobby, the anti-lobby in England and Wales is very, very strong. So there's not been a lot of progress on there. In fact, I mean, I'm sure you've seen it. As I walk around making podcasts and not making podcasts, I see more and more footpaths disappearing. I see more and more barriers to... We're quite lucky here.
Yes.
We can get around, although the barriers are mostly water.
Water, yeah. But I mean,
This must be the amphitheatre.
I think back to the Kinder Scout trespass, you know, of the pioneers of the right to roam movement, who staged a mass trespass on Kinder Scout.
Benny Rothman and gang, yeah.
And, you know, which has been much immortalised in song.
There would be lots of folk songs about that.
Yes,
yeah.
And certainly we've walked with a singer called Johnny Campbell, who sings a song about the Winter Hill Trespass, which is another similar movement. And those were people who were, you know, I feel empathy with, because I come from Sheffield. They were trying to get out of the industrial dirt and murk and smoke, and you know, get access to the lungs of the countryside, and they protested in their hundreds to do achieve it. And I feel some sympathy for them, I have to say. I mean, I have to keep an impartial view because I'm a BBC broadcaster, but I feel a great deal of sympathy for the people we've interviewed who are campaigning to get more access for people to the countryside.
Yes, I mean, the fears of landowners and farmers were slightly realised during the pandemic, when a lot of people who'd never been to the countryside before were forced to explore their locality or take holidays in Britain.
But the right of access comes with responsibility, it seems to me, and education is needed, you know, so that people understand the reasons for the need to be careful, the need to close gates, the need to not set fires, the need to take your litter home with you, and so on. So you need an educational program and a communications program alongside the right of access, which warns people and reminds people of their responsibilities when they go into the countryside. Would you like to come for a swim through
the bubble? Yeah, this does look... you've got slightly higher boots than me. This is... I'm surprised not to see frog spawn in this one.
Yeah, it's quite deep.
So we've crossed the lane from the main town, and the amphitheatre lies ahead.
Here is the amphitheatre. This is amazing. So it literally is as though we are gladiators walking into the stadium now. Can you imagine the crowd roaring as we come through this wall?
There's a buzzard settled to feast on our remains.
Exactly, probably. But we are walking onto the floor of the amphitheatre, a great big circular space.
There's an oval Oh, blackbird. Yes, it's an oval, of a built-up oval, and you can see the banks where the spectators would have sat. Mostly brambles and oak trees and holly trees. But what an amazing place.
It's not hard to imagine what this would have been like in its heyday, is it? I've just been on holiday in Rome, actually, to the end of last year, and went to the Colosseum. So I'm feeling echoes of... I mean, that's a much grander space than this, but this is pretty large, isn't it?
You could imagine some... Well, what has happened in here? Some fighting. Pretty unpleasant
Yes.
This is a great thing. Well, come to Silchester. Come to Khalifa. I have to come back to do a special podcast just on this history here, because this is absolutely incredible.
I'd definitely listen to that.
And so a huge thank you to Matthew for coming over to Silchester and roaming with the Romans with me. His podcast, Folk on Foot, is such a glorious celebration of folk music, old and new. And I think it makes a lovely companion to the podcast, of course. And I'll definitely make it back to Silchester for a proper exploration. Loads of great stories hidden in the landscape here, and it'll make a perfect podcast for later in the year. Don't forget, we love to receive your emails and social media posts. You can email me and the team at editor@countryfile.com. And you can find us on BBC Countryfile Magazine's Instagram and Facebook pages. So do leave comments about what you love about the podcast. And on that note, all positive feedback and likes and that sort of thing on whichever podcast provider you use, it's a huge help. Next week is the very last in this season of Stories from the Landscape. I join angler and TV presenter Will Millard in search of another legend, the water wolf, aka the pike. Will we get close to one of these giants of our freshwaters? Join us to find out. But for now, it's goodbye from me and the team. This episode of the podcast was produced in Bristol by Jack Bateman and Lewis Dobbs.